This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 344 was produced on October 6, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. October is upon us. Does that mean that the other shoe is about to drop and markets are going to crash like 2008? Or could it be that precisely because so many people think that's what's about to happen, that the opposite is actually more likely? We're trying to focus on finding more guests with views who differ from my own. So I'm particularly excited to welcome back Hante Investments founder and fund manager Alex Gurevich as this week's feature interview guest. Alex agrees with me that the macro risks are extremely high right now. But not only does Alex disagree with those of us who fear that the inflation problem could run away into an inflationary depression, Alex sees a nearly opposite outcome, more along the lines of a deflationary depression. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after Eric's feature interview with Alex Gurevich, when Eric, Nick, and I discuss everything from the S&P 500, the VIX, dollar, oil, and we wrap it up looking at gold. Now, Eric, before we get to our feature interview with Alex Gurevich, let's cover crude oil. OPEC Plus met yesterday and announced a historic 2 million barrel production cut, outraging the White House and driving oil prices much higher. Please give us a scoop on what's going on, including this week's EIA inventory data.
Patrick, in my opinion, the OPEC Plus announcement has been badly misunderstood or misinterpreted by most market participants. So let's go over exactly what happened and what it means. OPEC announced a 2 million barrel cut. Most people are calling that a production cut. That's not what it is. It is a cut in production quotas, the maximum amount that each member country is allowed to produce. So it sounds like 2 million barrels is a big number. Well, the thing is, many of those countries are already producing as much as they can, and they're producing well below their quotas. OPEC Plus overall is producing 3.58 million barrels per day, less than the quotas that have been established under the existing agreement before they cut them. So most market participants have looked at this and said, oh, they're going to cut 2 million barrels. That means 2 million barrels a day of oil is coming off the market. Well, wait a minute. That's just not what happened. What they did is they cut the production quota, not the production, but the production quota by 2 million barrels. Well, if they're already producing 3.58 million barrels less than the quota, and you reduce the quota by 2 million barrels, well, it sounds like actually the production stays exactly the same, and now they're just producing 1.58 million barrels below quota instead of 3.58 million barrels below quota, but there is no change in production. Well, actually, that analysis is wrong too, and the reason that that's wrong is that you have to look at this in terms of each individual country and what happened to its production quota. Most countries are going to have production quotas that come down, but they're still well above the maximum amount that that country is capable of producing. Therefore, it's meaningless. However, there are other countries, notably Saudi Arabia, Russia, United Arab Emirates, that are able to increase their production. So if you actually bother to do the analysis on this, and it doesn't seem like Bloomberg and the other folks that report this stuff for a living are doing that analysis, what you find out is it really means that there's about an 800,000 barrel per day actual cut of production if there is strict and complete compliance with what was announced today. Well, frankly, OPEC seldom works that way, so there's really no reason to expect that either. But the number to think about here is 800,000, not 2 million. Or put another way, a cut of 2 million barrels of production quotas translates to a cut of 800,000 barrels of actual production, given the various dynamics of the different countries and where they were with their quotas and so forth before the announcement. Now, there were also some hints made before the announcement that maybe there would be additional voluntary cuts from Saudi Arabia and others, but that hasn't happened yet. So if it is going to happen, they must be waiting until the market needs to be rescued or something. They didn't do it on the same day as they announced the 2 million barrel reduction in production quotas, not in production. But the message is clear. The message is that OPEC is going to defend the price, and they're done playing nice with the White House. So I think that that's really the most important point. The signal here is that OPEC intends to defend the price, and for that reason, I do think that it's bullish. But the perception so many people have that 2 million barrels just came off the market is simply not correct. The other thing that most market participants are not paying attention to is after Wednesday's announcement, on Thursday morning, there was an announcement from Saudi Arabia, what's called OSP, where Saudi Arabia prices its oil to other countries. The pricing that was announced was holding Asian prices steady, not increasing them as many people expected, and then they reduced prices to Europe. And some people were completely confused by that. I think what's going on here is that OPEC Plus has become extremely frustrated with particularly the United States, but also with other countries that have strategic petroleum reserves, trying to figure out a way to prevent those countries from refilling those strategic petroleum reserves so that we won't have the kind of market volatility created by the Biden administration's reckless draining of the U.S. SPR. So I think the message between the lines, so to speak, from Saudi Arabia to China is stop refilling your SPR if you want to get the lower prices that we're giving to Europe. I don't know that for certain, but that's my interpretation of why they did that. Moving on to EIA inventory, what really happened was an utterly massive 7.6 million barrel drawdown on U.S. oil inventory, and that happened during what's supposed to be restocking season. This is the time of year when we're supposed to be building inventory so that we can get through the winter heating season. But 6.2 million barrels were recklessly drained out of the SPR this week. So even though the real drawdown was 7.6 million, the headline number only printed at 1.4 million thanks to the SPR. Finished products had massive drawdowns as well, 4.7 million barrels on gasoline, 3.4 million barrels on distillates. Now, those figures would suggest that we're seeing really, really extreme drawdowns. It should be a very, very bullish message. But you have to also consider that these data have been affected by the hurricane. Tape action was up in reaction to inventory, but it was already in motion to the upside as a result of the OPEC announcement. President Biden's SPR drain was supposed to end with the midterm elections in November, but wait, they've made a new announcement. After the OPEC announcement, the White House said that the U.S. would continue to drain the SPR, quote, as appropriate. If you ask me, as appropriate would mean that they never drained it at all. So it seems like OPEC Plus is this month's scapegoat for why President Biden is going to continue to jeopardize U.S. national security by draining an incredibly important asset at the worst possible time. I think the bottom is probably in at 76.25 on WTI. I also expect lots of volatility and fireworks through election season. The enormity of the coming global recession is not yet widely understood, so there's plenty of room for more downside shocks when the recession news gets worse, which I predict it will. Right now, my base case scenario is I think it's much more likely that the bullish effects will keep us up and that 76.25 will hold as the bottom. But hey, if we get more recession news more quickly and we don't get as much oil news, and particularly if everybody who thinks that 2 million barrels just came off the market actually does the homework and figures out that it was really only 800,000, maybe there's room for a new lower low before this is over. But we're certainly in a bottoming process. If the final bottom isn't in, I think it's very near. Bottom line, I remain extremely bullish. I added to my longs in advance of the OPEC announcement, and I'll continue to buy the dips.
This week's feature interview guest is Hante Investment founder Alex Gurevich. Eric, why did we get Alex back on the show this week?
Patrick, we've been looking for guests with views opposing my own, but we don't want the knuckleheads on CNBC and Bloomberg who don't know anything and can't see what's really going on. Now, Alex Gurevich is no dummy. This is an absolutely brilliant macro guy with a very, very strong fixed income background. He sees the inflation-deflation situation almost exactly opposite from my own view. And that's the reason that I wanted to get him back on, is to understand why a guy who's as smart as Alex is doesn't see inflation the way I do and actually sees a nearly opposite outcome. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Alex Gurevich is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Alex Gurevich, fund manager and founder of Hante Investments in San Francisco. Alex prepared a chart deck to accompany this interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, please just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click the red button above Alex's picture that says Looking for the Downloads. Alex, I've been really looking forward to this interview with you because, as you know, and most of our listeners know, one of the most important rules of investing is when you have a strong view to seek out smart people who disagree with you because maybe you're the one who's got it wrong. I have some views about inflation, which I think is not transitory. I think we're at the beginning of a secular inflation. And I'm also getting, frankly, pretty darn concerned about some of the macro shock events that we're seeing. The sterling crash, it seems to me like it's not a big surprise after the policy mistakes, in my opinion, that the UK and most of the European Union have made. Makes me wonder if we're headed toward a real calamity in Europe, a currency crash, that kind of thing. I know that you're someone who's incredibly smart and gifted and don't share those views. So please help me understand your perspective on all of this. Inflation, is it going to get worse? Is it a big deal? And what about these systemic risk events, the sterling crisis, the seemingly runaway appreciation of the dollar to a blow-off top? A lot of non-usual things going on right now. What do we make of all this? How do you interpret it?
Eric, well, first of all, thank you for having me back. It's good to be back. It's been a while, and it's always a pleasure. Those are definitely the subjects you're bringing are the salient subjects for the day, like what we're thinking about, what we're pondering. Definitely, we were all watching in awe the price action on sterling over the last few months and especially over the last few weeks. Yes, I'm actually not sharing the situation that I'm not sharing the view that European and British economies are collapsing. In fact, I actually relatively positive. I'm positive on euro, I'm positive on sterling, and I'm positive on stock markets and economic growth there. And I want to try to unfold why. However, having said that, I am positive. I agree with the concerns about the systemic risk there, and I will be the first one to admit I do not know the scope of systemic risk. I also do not know how post-Brexit, for example, Britain will recover its current account, because definitely Brexit hurt their current account balance, which led to currency depreciation. Can they return the balance of payments? What are they going to export, right? What does Britain have to make to sell to the world? Those are legitimate concerns. But I'm also going to talk to you about why I'm reasonably positive on this region. Does it make sense?
Makes sense to me.
So first of all, a few days ago, or maybe like a couple of weeks ago, when was that Britain came out, the new prime minister came out with a very expansionary fiscal policy, and that caused a currency crash, like a really precipitous acceleration of pound down. For me, that was actually a very strong buy signal for the pound. Not the fact whether it's down or up on the day, but the fiscal expansion. Fiscal expansion is actually very positive for domestic currency when it's not being accommodated by their central bank. Now, the argument is that people are making that it is being accommodated, that a Bank of England is way behind the curve, that their policy is way too low relative to the inflation. I think we can address those in further on because we wanted to talk about inflation and why I don't think that central bank policies are at all accommodative, and I think they're tremendously restrictive right now. And I actually think that the banks, the central banks who are right now seem to be like behind the curve, like Bank of Japan and Bank of England, that the banks will have the last laugh as the rest of the world will head into catastrophic deflation. They'll have a more balanced policy because they will not have to cut rates so precipitously because they will have more kind of pent-up monetary looseness to combat the global monetary contraction that is happening. So I actually think that Britain is going to find itself in a decent position. They're doing fiscal expansion to stimulate the economy, and they're going to methodically raise interest rates, not accommodate it. And that combination of those things actually is very positive for the economy because that will improve their current account just by the virtue of their debt becoming more plentiful and more attractive. Because when you issue debt, foreigners end up at some price buying it, and that improves your capital account balance, which in turn improves your current account balance. It's almost no choice. This process has to happen. And I think sterling has much higher to go. And Europe, I think, has to work through some issues. But I think it's on a good track because one way or another, Europe is facing an energy crisis. And one way or another, they're facing a lot of dysfunctions and bureaucracy. But what my anticipation is that they're kind of cornered into inevitability of action. So they will inevitably have to do something about the energy infrastructure and get rid of the foreign energy dependence or diminish it, and eventually, which will eventually improve their terms of trade. But that actually creates a huge area for fiscal stimulus that is coming in the next few years, both in the area, first of all, both in various defense budgets and in the area of energy infrastructure. So that's good for stock market, that's good for domestic currency, that's good for growth. I feel it is somewhat inflationary. The situation in both Britain and Europe is somewhat inflationary, but I think only a year or two from now, we will think of it as a good thing, not as a bad thing anymore. That's my central view.
I want to follow up specifically on the energy crisis in Europe and the UK policy response, because as you were talking, something I realized is my own inflationist bias is probably contributing to my view on this, because when I heard that the intention of the UK's new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, was essentially a program of handouts to make it easier for people to pay their energy bills, that, as you know, doesn't solve the problem of high prices. High prices are the solution to high prices. You need to create more supply and you need to reduce demand. And giving money out to people just makes inflation worse and makes the energy problem worse. But that is coming from someone who sees this as an inflation problem. I suppose if you don't have that view, then it probably makes sense, given the dire circumstances, to do that. Do you think that fiscal policy that gives money to people, that, in my opinion, undermines the demand destruction objective that they should have, is good policy? Because I can't possibly see how it could be good policy if you have my inflation view. But if you have a deflationist view, maybe it is. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting, the handouts are a funny thing. Because imagine that every time you, like, okay, we can talk in pounds or in dollars, right? Imagine every time you go to a gas station, they give you a dollar or a pound, right? The government subsidizes this transaction by a pound, right? Now, there's two ways to subsidize it. They give a pound to the owner of the gas station, and then gas costs half a pound less, right? And both the customer and the gas station are better by half a pound, right? But the registered price now half a pound lower, right, for the gas. Now, imagine the opposite. They give half a pound for the customer, for the buyer. Then they're price goes up by half a pound. Both sides again split the profit. Both sides make the same. Like whether you give the pound directly to subsidize the buyer by a pound, the demand by a pound, or the supply by a pound, everybody ends up with the same amount of money, but the price is different by a pound. Does it make sense? Or am I talking too fast?
No, it's not too fast. I understand. I guess what it seems to me that if you have
you can create an illusion of deflation or inflation, whether you stimulate demand or supply, but it's really the same thing, right? Nothing really changes. Everybody is in the same place in terms of their financial outcome. And that's why I was a little bit, but that's part of the reason why I don't really believe in a catastrophic inflation now. That kind of supply pull, demand push, catastrophic, and it's not really what I think of dangerous inflation. It's more of a, like, illusionary inflation. It's not illusionary, it's very real in terms of what people have to pay for stuff, but it's created by this very particular circumstances. And we can go into inflationary situation later, but I really would like to discuss it. But yes, I think clearly fiscal policies, clearly, no doubt, if fiscally you're going to hand money out, that's inflationary. But if for every dollar you hand out, you issue a bond, which is not being bought by your central bank and by somebody else, you're sucking this money that you put into the circulations right back out of the system by selling a bond. So every bit of fiscal expansion is being sucked out back by issuing government debt, which is not accommodated. Now, you could argue that it goes a little different places. Like when you give money to low-income people who have marginal propensity to consume, it feeds into inflation stronger than the money you take out from balance sheets by selling bonds, because that hurts more asset prices rather than consumption. So there are some imbalances there, but eventually the recent spiral down in asset prices will probably affect consumption as well eventually.
Let's move on to the inflation topic then, because for more than a decade now, my view has been, okay, very, very strong deflationary macro backdrop has clearly been dominant for the last decade. And the way I've looked at things is, look, you can have all these discussions about pros and cons of QE, is it good, is it bad, whatever. At the end of the day, you can paper over almost any problem with printed money if you've got a printing press and you have the luxury of a deflationary macro backdrop where you don't cause a problem when you print that money. What I've always said is someday the way the shit really hits the fan is the day we get to secular inflation, to the point where any attempt to try to salvage the economy by printing money or subsidizing anything just exacerbates the inflation and makes it worse. At that point, central bankers' hands are tied and they can't do anything. And I've said it's coming and I don't know when. And, you know, as we've come out of the pandemic, I thought, boy, the inflation is really visible. And then all the experts said, no, it's transitory and it's peaked already. Okay, well, then the same exact people that said it's peaked, now it hasn't quite peaked and it's still transitory. Seems to me like there's an awful lot of evidence that we may be headed into a new secular inflation. I'm not smart enough to forecast or predict these things, but it does seem like most of the experts that have been very, very confident that it was transitory or that it had peaked already haven't been right quite yet. So how do you see this? Are we really still in a deflationary backdrop? Is that going to persist?
Well, I think, first of all, you are correct about a number of those things as exhibited by actual printed numbers on the price action, right? Before we start arguing about what happens in the future, let's look at page 3 on my chart deck. This is the chart that I used to call the one chart. I've been following it for many, many years. It's a chart of roll-adjusted bond futures. And as you can see, depending on how you draw the channel, since for 40 years, U.S. bond futures were in a rising channel. And depending on how you draw this channel, I probably, like this is here, it's drawn a little generously, but you could argue that it broke to upside a little bit in 2020. But there is no question that no matter how you draw this channel, it broke down. This is a 40-year channel that there's no question that it broke down this year. And the scope of the bear market...
And that does not strike you as a sign of maybe a secular inflation beginning?
It's just something to pay attention to. I do not, first of all, I never derive from price action on assets any economic conclusions. It's not how my mind works. But I just pay attention. Price action tells me only about price action. Like, I don't think that because bonds went down, that's inflationary. I think that there is a way, looking back, because price action, we see what has happened over the last 2 years, right? And we can see that over the last 2 years, we no longer could say that we're in a secular bull market on bonds. That's not an argument. From my perspective, it's a fact. the secular bull market in bonds that went from 1980 to 2020 finished in 2020, and we played out the bear market. The question is it the end of short bear market, or are we going into longer secular bear market in bonds? And I'm very convinced, I'm very strongly convinced that it's just a short bear market in bonds, and I will try to explain why. But
okay, so this, we should think of this as the head fake that is maybe going to trick a bunch of people into thinking that the situation has changed. You're thinking this is going to be a false breakdown, and we'll be back up in that channel on page three. In what time frame? Within a year?
Honestly, I don't think we'll be back in this channel. I think we will rally tremendously through this channel on the upside.
Above the channel. So you think we're going to penetrate, we're below the channel now. You think we're going to penetrate the channel and trade well above the top of the channel?
Yes, which is kind of hard to imagine because we're looking at 200 prices. We're looking at zero interest rates on 30-year bonds. But it might sound a little extreme and sensationary for me to say that because there's all sorts of sensationalists to say that, right? There could be lots of other outcomes, but I want to step by step explain why I think feel so strongly. There are different forces in play. And I think you're correct that there are some very short-term inflationary forces. There are some deflationary cyclical forces. Then there are semi-secular inflationary forces, which have to do with like green energy transition, change of globalization, like kind of world order. And then there are longer deflationary trends. So between those four different trends working against each other, all sorts of things can play out. But I want to kind of, in my simplest way of the view, what I do know, I want to explain why I'm so confident that rates will be 0 to 2 years from now and stay zero for quite a while.
Please do. I'm all ears.
Yeah, probably never had such a strong confidence on, it was a couple of times when I had similar confidence. Probably the only time I possibly had stronger confidence in being long bonds was 2014. And the second high confidence point was 2018. That's in the recent history. The other point was more about my confidence in risk parity trade in 2002, but I rarely have that high confidence. So first of all, I was listening very careful to Powell during his press conference, and I was trying to understand, is there something they know that I don't? Because my assumption is that they know more than I do because they all have all the information. They spend all the day studying this stuff. I'm not an economist. So I told myself, I'm just going to go by what he's saying. I'm not going to contradict anything he says. Now let's go through what he says. He reiterated that the lags from policy are long and variable. This is a very difficult thing to internalize. No matter how many times we repeat that, it's very difficult to believe that the policy does not affect inflation right away. And right away means the lag of actual inflationary impact is between 1 and 2 years. Saying that it's 1 year, that's generous. Now I invite all listeners right now to close their eyes, take a deep breath, and really try to internalize the idea. Nothing we see about inflation and job market in 2022 has anything to do with policy in 2022. So the policy changes in 2022 could not possibly in any imaginable world have any effect yet on inflation or job market. Job market probably has a little less lag than inflation. So the job market that we're seeing right now is a product of economic conditions in 2021. And the inflation numbers that we're seeing right now are the product of fiscal and monetary policy in 2000. So let's just all think it through. Imagine this, like nothing that they do has any effect on those numbers right now. So now we've took a pause, right? Now let's go to the next step. Powell himself said, what are they watching it? What is their favorite measure? Their favorite measure is core PCE, right? And he mentioned that it's very stable, like 3 years. He talked about 3 years, 6 month, 12 month horizon, 4.8, 4.5, 4.8. It's high, but it's not spiraling up. It's stable over the year of 2022. That means that economic and financial conditions that existed in 2020 and 2021, which were tremendous rally in stock market, which were unprecedented monetary and fiscal expansion, led to stable and high core inflation this year. They also led to the job market that we're seeing this year. The job market and the inflation numbers that we'll see the next 2 years are going to be the product of monetary and fiscal conditions right now. We have negative fiscal impulse. We have unprecedented rise in interest rates. We have tremendous rise in dollar, which also is somewhat tightening. We have a collapse in asset prices, somewhat unprecedented too, because we very seldom had both bonds and stocks go down, which just shrinks collateral and takes out ability to lend from the financial system. None of those things yet could have possibly in any world have any effect on inflation or job market that we're seeing today. They are affecting the job market inflation we're seeing in 2024. So what we're going to see in 2024 is the product of what is happening today. So are you following me up to this step?
Absolutely.
So now the question, the real question is, and this is where you can, like, I might be like coming on very strong and saying like, I got it. There is no other point of view. There is a argument point, because the question is whether the measures that have been taken in 2022 have enough traction, whether they will really bring inflation down, right? That's the question. That's the $1 trillion question. Now, we cannot judge whether they had traction from inflation numbers today. They're irrelevant to the idea whether Fed has traction. So we can only look at leading indicators, and we could disagree about them. Because, for example, one counter argument to my argument I was saying is that like wages are doing really well and the wage inflation might be entrenched. And even if inflation moderates somewhat, that only will only be supportive of real wages. And if real wages go up, that consumers will continue being in good shape. People talk about credit impulse and various other indications showing that balance sheets are still strong. That is a counter argument. However, what I do see is asset prices coming in. I do see commodities prices falling. Why do I think that sooner or later consumer and everything else will break down? Well, because the Fed told me so. They told us that they are determined to bring inflation down to 2%. Now, we already accepted as an axiom that nothing they do will affect inflation for 1 to 2 years. So by the time inflation starts coming down, they will see actually inflation coming down as a lagging indicator. They will be 1 or 2 years behind the curve. They will have been tightening for 2 years over the period of time that they should have been easing, which by the way, I believe that currently the correct policy would be to be easing. But they're still tightening because they're still looking at the lagging indicators. Suppose current policy is not high enough. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, they'll keep tightening till it is. Maybe they'll tighten to 4%. Maybe they'll tighten to 5%. Who knows what the terminal rate is, but they spelled out that they're going to tighten until they see lagging indicators coming down. How can they, when inflation starts coming down, there will be additional tightening happening from the fact that real rates will go up, because if inflation is 5%, let's say core inflation is 5%, because headline bill jumping all over, right? And right now we still have negative real rates backward looking, quite a bit negative. If it comes down to zero, suddenly we have quite a bit positive real rates, and the environment of overall fragile economy, those positive real rates will be decelerating economy very fast. And there is no way they're in the mindset of immediately cut rates. They're still looking to raise rates. So they kind of bake themselves in a situation of being behind the curve.
Let's go back to Jay Powell and core PCE and the Fed's focus on core PCE. I remember the speech that you're talking about where Jay Powell said that. And if I'm not mistaken, what he actually said was the reason that we focus on core PCE rather than headline is that the monetary policy tools that we have don't really work on food and energy, the things that are excluded. And it seems to me like, whoa, when I heard him say that, I almost fell off my chair, because I follow energy very, very closely as an oil trader. I recently interviewed Lee Gehring about what he thinks is a coming global food crisis. And I'm thinking, okay, the two things that are completely out of control that we don't have a solution for, in the case of energy, it's just a matter of insufficient supply. We haven't invested in new exploration and in development of new supply capacity. And we could. It's not like the world ran out of oil, but we stopped drilling the oil wells. And we're getting to the point where we're out of spare capacity. And from a policy standpoint, everything that governments are doing is discouraging solving that problem. Now, it's all solvable problems, Alex, but they're solvable problems that take 5 to 10 years to solve, because you don't just build an atomic power plant or, you know, an aggressive plan of deep offshore drilling or something overnight. It takes years for that stuff to play out. So it seems to me, Alex, that by the Fed's own admission, we're facing a situation where the tools they have to fight inflation don't work on the kind of inflation that it seems to me is nearly certain to continue. What am I missing?
Well, I guess my disagreement, I agree, but what I disagree that I don't even call what's happening inflation, because I agree with you and I agree with them. The tools almost work backwards, because think about what happens if you raise interest rates. It becomes all the harder to even it's already very hard to start a new prospecting for oil or new drilling venture. How does raising interest rates will encourage people to do it, right?
Oh, no, that's not the solution, clearly.
They're contributing to the energy prices by raising interest rates. I don't think how it helps the result of raising interest rates resolving the food crisis. Food is even worse than energy, because what happens, I think personally what's going to happen to energy is that energy demand will just dramatically crater over the next 2 years, like very, very seriously, because the point is that...
Well, how does that work?
Well, dollars are being taken out of the system. There is no question of that. Like, amount of dollars in the world to pay for anything is shrinking. First of all, through the rise of dollar, through the unwind of balance sheet, and through the rise of interest rates, for the collapse in asset prices, which creates less collateral. So there is less dollars. There is less dollars to pay for everything. So people need energy. There are certain energy needs which are a lot more elastic and certain less elastic. So manufacturing takes a lot of energy. People eventually, if people don't have money to pay for this energy, they won't pay for it. If you keep making new dollars like they did in 2020 and 2021, those dollars will go somewhere. And wherever there is a shortage of anything, they'll pour into it and it will spike. And that's what we're seeing today. Again, we're seeing today the energy spike as a result of monetary policy of 2020, 2021. Going forward, there will be not enough dollars. Sooner or later, when people run out of dollars, they just won't have dollars to buy oil with. So which means that, like, we're seeing stuff like manufacturing plants being just shutting down in Germany. That's not an inflationary process. Yes, you could say, like, yes, whatever widgets they're making will be even more expensive because it'll be harder to get them. But I don't think that's the kind of inflation that you fight with monetary policy. In that sense, I think they're correct. What's happening is just that economy will be forced to shrink to accommodate if there is not enough dollars.
Okay, let's back up for a second because I want to make sure I understand this. At first, my reaction was to say, wait a minute, Alex, what are you talking about? How is demand going to crater? Because if you've got a certain amount of economic demand, there's got to be energy demand. The only way I could see demand cratering completely would be in a deflationary depression. It sounds like you're saying, yeah, that would be it. A deflationary depression, that's what's coming. Am I reading you right? Because you didn't say deflationary depression.
Yes, I think that's the most likely direction we're going to, deflationary depression. And paradoxically, this is going back to the beginning of the conversation. We talked about systemic risks. Especially in the U.S., they seem to be not so much systemic risks. And that's why I think we're going into depression. Because in the past, at this stage of the cycle, something will already blow up. Like, would have something like a global financial crisis happening, right? Somebody's going bankrupt, major high-profile things happening, clear crisis, and the Fed would quickly pivot. In every other situation, by now, they would have pivoted. But because we have high inflation, because nothing high backward-looking inflation, because nothing has blown up, it seems like there is no choice for them to just drive this economy into the ground slowly and painfully. It's not an overnight thing. Just as this bear market in stocks, it's not like a crash of March 2020. It's been going on for several months with a lot of rebounds, a lot of bounces, but they keep driving this thing into the ground because they're sucking out dollars out of the system. And I see really no way out of it. I think when I say no way out, clearly there are ways out. Every time I make such a strong statement, I just want to reiterate for listeners, I think in terms of probabilities. What is the most likely outcome? So what I'm saying is that there is no way for me to not think that this is the most likely outcome, deflationary depression and probably global depression, in which paradoxically, I think the people who will look best will be Europe, and Japan.
Well, this is an absolutely fascinating conversation, Alex, because you're one of very few people in the world who I think would agree with me that we're headed probably or maybe toward a global depression, not recession, but depression, really bad stuff. Yet I see it as painfully clear that if you can see there's a depression coming, it ought to be obviously clear that it's an inflationary depression. You're saying the almost exact opposite, which is the only way for this really to play out is a deflationary depression. And I'm just getting my head around that. And I started to say, well, Alex, it can't be that, because look at the energy situation alone. In order to run anything remotely close to the current economy, we're going to have producing assets continue to deplete, which is just the natural way that oil wells work. We're not replacing them. We're not going to be able to meet current demand. So prices can't possibly crater. And I think what you're saying is, no, I didn't say meet current demand. I said the economy completely goes to shit. And that's the way you get to low energy prices, is because it's not that we found a solution. It's not that we found a better way. It's that we had an economic dislocation that was so bad that things are shutting down so much that we're not consuming that much energy, because the world is a very screwed up place. I want to make sure that I'm not reading too much into that, because those are some pretty darn strong statements. I agree with them on every aspect of it, except we see inflation versus deflation differently, which is fascinating.
Well, yeah, that's I guess more or less this is what
it
I
is
see.
That strong, though. You're saying depression, not recession, and you're talking about energy demand destruction that's huge.
I think depression versus recession, to me, it's not just about the depth. I think it's just going to be longer. It's going to be longer than previous recessions and more broad, because we're having, even though, as I said, I'm slightly more positive on Europe, but Europe is, no matter how optimistic you can be in Europe, it's still in dire straits. And as I mentioned earlier, I might not see a lot of problems with it. So Europe is having a lot of problems. US is driving itself into the ground relentlessly. And China is kind of in trouble too. So we have three biggest regions in the world synchronously going into kind of recessionary environment. And in the middle of happening this, as you pointed out, energy prices are probably going to stay high until we see dramatic shrinkage of demand. So that acts as tightening, and central banks are draining out liquidity. This is a very negative situation, and I don't know how to get out of it. I mean, over the 10 years, probably we'll resolve it by finding alternative sources of energy, building energy infrastructure. But it's kind of like they say, that which is not sustainable cannot be sustained. If there is not enough dollars to pay for energy to maintain economy at current levels, economy will not be maintained at current levels. It's that simple.
Let's go back to page 3, and the title, of course, is really starting to resonate for me, the one chart. It seems to me that if we look at this channel here and the breakdown that has begun below the bottom of the channel, as we discussed earlier, you think that's a fake break and that eventually we're moving much higher. It seems to me that watching what happens here is about the most important thing that an investor can do, because either you're right, in which case this head fake is going to continue to frustrate people like me who think that this is going much lower and eventually it's going to reverse and go much higher. Or I'm going to be wrong, or you're going to be wrong, and it is going to go much lower. Boy, it's awfully hard if you're not absolutely certain, which it is, to put trades on, because the trades I'm putting on, I'm betting that you and I are on the opposite sides of. We're both smart guys, but if you don't get this inflation versus deflation thing, you can't possibly navigate this environment, can you?
Yeah, that's a tough. It's a tough, of course. What I try to focus is bet on things that I have more certainty about. When I think about bonds and I look at this chart, obviously I'm a little cautious, because this chart looks like, you look at the numbers and looks like to me like it's going to 100 if I just look at the chart, right? Which means 6% yield on the bond on bonds, right? Visually, it just looks like it's going there to me, like as a amateur chartist. I have to remember, bonds is just an asset. Asset has buyers and sellers. There is no right price for it. It can go to any price where buyers meet the sellers. So if bonds crash another 10 points and yields go up another 100 basis points, that's just what happens, because there was more sellers than buyers. I'm interested in like more like where the policy will be 2 or 3 years from now. And I have very strong conviction that the most likely level is zero for policy to be 2 years from now. And this is where I focus my interest. because no matter what the charts and the markets and the technicals do, if the Fed starts cutting rates at the beginning of next year, as both myself and the market projects them to do, they probably will not be able to stop and they will go all the way to zero, or at least significantly lower.
And to make sure that I understand this, the reason that you are expecting interest rates to drop to zero in the next couple of years is what specifically? Because economic activity is so badly damaged that they have no choice but to try to stimulate the economy?
Yes, and I think they will see inflation numbers go negative.
So you're not expecting disinflation. You're expecting honest to God deflation, prices going down on stuff.
Yes, that's what I think is the most likely scenario. Because if the expansionary policy of 2020, 2021 led us to these levels, to the levels of core PCE being stable between 4 and 5%, then that it tells me that the current policy will lead it to be negative 1, negative 2% 2 years from now.
Alex, let's move on to page 4, because I know a lot of our listeners are dying to get to the punchline here, which is, what does all of this mean for the stock market? If you're talking about deflation persisting for several years, much lower policy rates, what does that mean in terms of what we can expect for equity markets?
Okay, yes, that's definitely probably the question that is on the mind of a lot of investors. So I invite you to look at page 4 on my chart deck. And this is the chart I've published in my book first in 2015, in my first book, The Next Perfect Trade. And I alluded to this relation in my second book, The Trades of March 2020, that came out earlier. When did it come out? It came out earlier this year. I'm like already losing track of when I published the books.
The last time you were interviewed was when the book was coming out. I remember that.
Yeah, well, it's been a long year. You could tell, like, a lot happened in the markets this year. So it feels like it's been a long time ago, right? So what I'm saying, I refer to this chart a lot. As you see, you have an orange line and a blue line, and they have a pretty decent fit. You could see that there is a correlation there. And the orange lines show, so from given moment, the blue line shows us how did the interest rates change over the last 2 years, and the orange line shows us how will the stock market change over the next 2 years. So what this chart shows, this is a lagged fit, how interest rate momentum predicts the stock market momentum. And the fit was very good. For example, you see the spike in blue in 2016. What happened in 2016 in terms of, I'm just going to more recent history. That was Brexit. Rates went down. Stocks were kind of looking weak. And you see the big spike in orange. That's what happened over the next 2 years. Up to 2018, we had an excellent rally in stock market. Now look at the blue line in 2018. That was the corresponding to the rise of interest rates from 2016 to 2018. And you see the corresponding down spike in orange, which means that between 2018 and 2020, we had a poor performance of stock market, including COVID, right? Now go to 2020, we see the blue line going way up, and which was reflect probably as high as it's been. You could kind of see like it's right at the top of where it's ever been. That's how much the interest rates have fallen around COVID time relative when they were 2 years ago. And you see a huge orange spike around it, which is a huge performance of stock market between 2020 and 2022. Since then, the synchronicity was not that great. What happened is that stock market started to fall even more precipitously than it usually does in those situations. And I think I suspect it's because the tightening was multifaceted, not just from interest rates, but also from fiscal policy. Do you see that orange line, which shows 2 year on year performance of stock market, how it went from like 100% up on 2 years to almost flat on 2 years?
Alex, I just want to make sure that I understand how I should be interpreting this chart. Do I understand correctly that the blue line is basically a forecast of where the orange line should be? So if we look at where the blue line ends at the right edge of the chart, that on the right scale is showing us where we are in the bond market, but then we look on the left scale and we find that that's projecting about a 57% decline in the S&P is what we should expect. Is that a peak to trough decline, or what kind of number is that?
Roughly peak to trough, I would say, because it's a percentage decline. Yeah.
So basically, you're saying the bond market now is telling us to expect the S&P to get down to essentially a 58% or 42, to reach a value which would be 42% of its previous high at 4,800.
Yeah, something like that. This is not a very, as you can see, the fit is not very precise. But
so that's about 2,000 on the S&P. That's a pretty darn low number.
Yes, that's a pretty consistent with how this chart has been working out over the last 25 years or so.
Okay, but you are saying around 2,000, 2,100 on the S&P is about what's being targeted or what this chart is indicating may be coming.
Yes. If you just take, I would not put so much value, like I wouldn't be so focused. Like it doesn't mean that I would be personally targeting 2,100 because this is just one indicator. Those fits are fuzzy and not always perfect. But yeah, something like this seems quite reasonable. And I think it's quite consistent with the idea of synchronous global depression.
Alex, I'm just processing all of this because, frankly, a lot of people think that I'm a little eccentric and awfully bearish about where things are headed. I've been telling people when the S&P was still well above 4,000, I said, hey, I don't understand why it's above 3,000. Everybody told me 3,000 was a crazy low number. You're talking 2,000. How should I interpret this bearishness? Are you really thinking this is end of the world stuff? Or is this just a cyclical thing that the economy has to work through? How do we make sense of what you think is coming?
I definitely don't think about the end of the world. If it comes, it will catch me by surprise. I'm reasonably positive about and optimistic about the future of the world. I don't think there's anything strange or unusual about 50, 60% top to bottom on S&P 500. It kind of happens before once in a while, or like you can see that happening in 2007, for example, something similar. And you can see it happening in 2000, maybe not exactly those numbers, but it would be very consistent with those numbers. And the interest rate momentum and the overall momentum from interest rates and fiscal policy and balance sheet is more negative in any of those occasions. So I don't see any reason or any reason to be like disturbed by the fact that it may go there. Having said that, my bearishness on stock market always has a caveat. I believe that in the long run, stock market always will go up. Well, it's more likely to go up than down. And as soon as policy pivots and interest rates will actually, that as soon as this blue line, and this blue line can start going up very rapidly because both what we saw 2 years ago is kind of catching up to us to higher rates. And if the rate pivot here and started to go down, this blue line will start going up very rapidly and forecast a more better outcome for stocks. And when this blue line will cross the zero again, when the rates are lower today when they were 2 years ago, I will probably be a buyer of stocks. Honestly, this indicator just worked so well for me over the last 25 years. I see no reason not to continue following it.
Let's move on and talk about the consequences to the U.S. dollar, which you've got charted on page 5. Now, this is a fascinating one, Alex, because there's so many people who will tell you the dollar's days are numbered. It's going to be replaced as the global reserve currency, and therefore the dollar's going to crash. It's going to zero. And I have a very different view. My view is, yeah, I do think that the dollar is going to be replaced as global reserve currency, but I think that the dollar is going to appreciate in a global flight to safety as a lot of that bad stuff that you talked about happens. And I think that the biggest risk to the global economy is an out of control appreciation of the US dollar. How do you see this? Are we worried about the US dollar going up or down? Where's the risk? I think it's a risk of too much up.
Well, first of all, I have to admit, dollar has been confounding me over the last year or two. Because notice, if you look at the chart, the reason I posted the chart, like look at how it acted during different periods of time. In 2020, it started to go down from like 100 to 90 once the original crisis was over and they started to add liquidity. And I started to think that we might have a dollar down cycle like we did from 2001 to 2008 when it went from 120 to 70. I was really thinking we might have a huge kind of long-term bear market in the dollar. And obviously that's not what happened. I think that usually, what I do think is usually happens at the very end of the cycle, dollar usually goes down. And that is actually one of the counterarguments to my point that we're on the edge of recession in the US. Because look, for example, at the events of 2018. When we got to the end of cycle, in 2017, 2018, both dollar and bonds went down in the beginning of 2018. And only then dollar started, as things rolled over, dollar started to go up. So it feels to me that before, while the dollar is still grinding up, that's actually not an environment which typically is conducive of beginning of severe recession. First, dollar has to sell off. So my central scenario is that probably dollar is going to actually grind up, maybe possibly even to 120 again, or I don't know where it wants to be, that it could continue grinding, but at any point, it can have a severe correction. And that would be a sign probably that things are turning around.
Now, you're a fixed income expert, Alex, so I'm sure you must have an opinion on this question of the dollar and emerging market debt. The argument that a lot of people have posited is essentially that there's so much dollar-denominated debt that if you get above a certain level on the dollar index, it becomes impossible for all of those countries that have borrowed in dollars to repay, because they would be repaying a much larger multiple of their original borrowing amount as reflected in their own currency. Is that sensible logic? Is that the right way to think about this? And if so, what does it mean given these circumstances?
Well, you know, I'm somewhat confounded by this question, because yes, one would argue that there should be an emerging market crisis, but we're not seeing it. Brazil is doing quite well, which is usually like a good bellwether. Mexican currency is stable. Interestingly, Turkey, for example, you could argue, okay, commodity currencies are doing well, right? Because commodity prices have risen and they're catching up with dollar being stronger because they're commodity producers and whatever, they're having good terms of trade. But look at Turkey. Turkish currency has been depreciating, and they've been cutting interest rates. So they've been really diverging from the global policy. But it's depreciating very slowly. And over the last few months, it was actually, I think, depreciating slower than projected by the forwards. So if you were holding Turkish lira forwards, you're actually making money over the last few months. So something really strange is going on in the world. I don't see, in the one emerging market that is melting is China. This is one place where I think we're seeing a budding meltdown. What causes this dynamic? Why there is no emerging market crisis just triggered by... I think maybe dollar is not enough, just dollar here is not enough to cause an emerging market crisis. Maybe this time emerging markets raise their interest rates sufficiently, like Brazil was kind of ahead of the game, raising its own interest rates quite aggressively last year. And I think they got ahead of the game, and now they're seeing strong and stable currency. You can have all sorts of interesting theories about that. But do you see, like, I want to pose back to you, do you see emerging market, like, other than hypothetical meltdown that should occur, do you see any signs of the meltdown actually occurring? Because I don't.
No, I don't see them, and that's a quandary in my mind. And the question in my mind is, okay, there has to be some number, some level of the dollar where the repayment of that emerging debt becomes insurmountable. It's impossible for them to pay it back, and at that point, they just give up and say, we might as well default because we know that's where it's going to end up anyway. It seems to me there's got to be some magic number for the dollar index that when it gets to that level, it's all over for EM. Well, a lot of people thought it was 110. Obviously, that's not the number because we got all the way to almost 116 and, you know, it hasn't broken yet. It seems to me if you know that magic number, you've got an incredible amount of edge as a trader. But of course, that's an unknowable thing. So I thought I'd ask in case you had any insights.
Well, I have one idea about this. And that is the same thing I think that is related to what's happening in the U.S. economy and to the U.S. consumer. And why, for example, we're seeing U.S. consumer very robust, because you could make the same argument about U.S. consumer. Why are people like not, we don't see a dramatic pulling back on from U.S. consumer, despite the fact that interest rates have risen and asset prices have fallen. I think that there was a really big cushion building in 2020 in the world system by so many dollars being supplied in the world financial system, that there were so many dollars sloshing around that they kind of padded out the situation in various direct and indirect ways. They're possibly like through various swap lines and various holdings. We might not see it in exact numbers of foreign exchange reserves of various countries, but what I feel is like there is a lot of cushion. And right now this cushion is being sucked out. Same thing consumers, like we're not seeing immediate consumer crisis because everybody's personal balance sheet is pretty good. And even balance sheets of corporations are pretty good going into this. So nothing blows up right away. And I think that's what's happening to emerging markets. The cushion was such a good cushion built in 2020 with this printing dollars that it takes a long time to suck those dollars out.
Well, Alex, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Hante Advisors. We do have a large institutional and accredited audience that are eligible to invest in hedge funds. And also, you've got two books out now. We've covered, don't remember if we did interviews on both of your books, but certainly the more recent book, we did an interview here on Macro Voices that listeners, you've just put Alex's name in the search box at macrovoices.com. You can find those previous interviews. But tell us what's in the books and also how people can contact you if they're interested in the fund.
Thank you very much. So as you mentioned, Hante Advisors or Hante Investments, depending upon how you look at the name, the website is www.honteinv.com. And accredited investors can go to this website and find out about investment opportunities with us. We have both institutional and retail-oriented programs, but they are all for accredited investors. I can be followed on Twitter at agorevich23, and on this, all the links to my books and my company's website could be found on Twitter. With regards to my books, yes, I have two books out. The first one came out in 2015. It's called The Next Perfect Trade. And I like to compare it that if you were the medical student, the first book is kind of like an anatomy textbook. In this book, I discuss my principles of trade selection step by step. But my second book, The Trades of March 2020, is like walking into an actual operating room. What I do in this book, I show blow by blow what is happening in a command center or a hedge fund during a pandemic crisis and what it's like to navigate crisis while you're both personally and professionally under pressure. I feel like this book has done a really good job, if I may say so myself, of showing people what it is really like to be there in the trenches when the crisis happens.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Alex back on the show. Now, joining us here in the postgame is Nick Galarnik, who we're going to be talking some charts with in the postgame. But before we get to that, what was your takeaway from the interview?
Patrick, I really enjoyed this interview because it forced me to reflect on many of my own convictions. Now, my view that we are inextricably in a global energy crisis, which is still in its infancy, has not changed and will not change, or at least not unless I get new data that causes it to change. I also think the food crisis thing is real, but the assumptions that I've been making that those inherently have to be inflationary, I really need to think through carefully. There is another viewpoint that a number of people in the peak oil community used to express, where they thought that counterintuitively, if you had an energy crisis which completely crushes the global economy, there would be a bullwhip effect where effectively that results in a complete collapse of economic activity, a collapse in demand, and then crude oil prices drop, even though it was scarcity and lack of sufficient crude oil that caused the economic dislocation to occur in the first place. Feedback loops and complex interactions like this can be hard to predict. So I have not changed my convictions about the energy and food crisis. I'm carefully reevaluating and rethinking my conclusion that it has to be inflationary. And, you know, I'll take it down from it has to be inflationary to about 90% confidence. It still doesn't make sense to me if the fundamental problem is there is a lack of something which is essentially needed. It seems to me the price has to go up, not down. So I'm still in the inflation camp. I haven't turned as a result of this interview, but it definitely got me thinking, and it got me to recognize that my strongest conviction is that we're in an energy crisis. The conclusion that that energy crisis must inherently be inflationary and that it's going to lead to runaway inflation, well, that I'm not quite as sure of. And so this interview really helped me to kind of distinguish those two things and realize that I have differing levels of conviction on the energy crisis, which I'm convinced of, versus the inflationary result of that energy crisis, which I'm still mostly convinced of.
All right, it's time for the chart deck. Let's get to it. Listeners, those of you that want to download the charts, you can go to the Macro Voices website and click the download button, or you can get it out of the Research Roundup email. Now, when looking at that S&P 500 on page 2, we had quite the bounce off of those lows around 3,600. It was a very rapid 200 S&P point rally from an incredibly oversold market. But while it was a pretty sharp run on the upside, I still think there's more bounce to go. Like, it would be very natural for this bounce to even get to 3,900, and even if it's robust enough to 4,000, and still be in primary downtrend and still have the potential to roll over and fail. Anyone who's hanging on here that this is already a bottom just because we bounced this way has already forgotten what the other bear market rallies have looked like. We've seen this rally back in March, which was almost 400 S&P points. We had that May rally, which was about 300 points. And then, of course, that robust June and then subsequently July rallies that were, you know, 500 plus points. And each time that market rolled over and sold again. So while we are bouncing, and while it certainly has room to go for another week, a couple hundred more points, I still think that it's too early to be already calling a market bottom. Now, Nick, I know you've been doing some analysis on the S&P. What are you thinking?
Thanks, Patrick. Yeah, no, I've been looking at SPX, which as I'm talking right now is at 3780 roughly, analyzing the expected move based on a straddle cost for the October 21st OPEX. We're looking at about a 170-point move in either direction, which denotes about a 4.5% move up or down. So the upside potential here is about 3950, downside around 3610. And the expected move for the November 18th OPEX, which is very important to look at because this factors in the U.S. midterm elections on November 8th. OPEX is November 18th, is about 280 points in either direction, which denotes about a 7.4% move by November. So we're going to see some volatility likely into November for sure. Upside potential there is 4,060. The downside potential is 3,500 or so, which is pretty key support as well. Looking at the put-to-call interest, 1.74. The market's pretty adequately hedged overall. And the IV right now is 26.5%, which denotes about 1.65% average daily moves. Looking at the NASDAQ, though, which is spot right now on 281 roughly on triple Qs, the 200-day moving average is right around 300, which is very, very far away from where we are right now. But for the November OPEX, again, factoring in midterm elections, the expected move is plus minus 25 points on triple Qs. So upside there is 306, 307, downside 256, 257 or so. And also remember, we have earnings coming up as well shortly too. This denotes for November, again, an 8.8% move up or down into the midterm elections. So we should see a lot of volatility coming about in the next couple of months. And on to the VIX now, I guess.
Yeah, no, we should definitely take a look at that VIX because it's surprisingly sticky up along the top.
Yeah, well, right now, as I speak, the spot's around 29 or so. And this denotes expected moves each day of about 1.8%. Now, looking at the longer-term chart, if anyone pulls up a longer-term chart of the VIX of about 20 years or so, what you'll notice is that it taps 35 pretty often and comes back down. This year alone, just some food for thought, We've tapped it 12 times already and reversed lower. So is it possible that we're heading back down on the VIX, which means we might stabilize for a bit? Possibly. However, keep in mind, we do have Q3 earnings coming up, as well as the November midterm elections in the United States. And those will be probably volatility-inducing events.
Yeah, Nick, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. Overall, with the S&P 500 bouncing this way, your target zones are pretty accurate. I think a move up towards 3,900 plus is still possible. But the one thing all of our listeners need to be aware, with the volatility this high, you know, 50 to 100 S&P point swings intraday is par for the course, right? Anyway, Eric, on the next page, we have the dollar index. What are you thinking?
Patrick, we've seen the blow-off top in the dollar index just as expected. Now the question is whether the rally resumes now that we've come back down to the trend line that was in play before that blow-off occurred, or if this was a major top and a trend reversal point. Now, it's still too early to tell that from the chart, but I'm going to posit that it is profoundly, profoundly important to watch closely and see what happens next. Because if this turns out to be a major high for the dollar, meaning that we've got a trend reversal and we're going to be trading down for the next several months, okay, that's one really important message. On the other hand, if we see the rally resume, and particularly if we move above this recent blow-off high, and particularly if we go over 120, that says to me that we've got a really serious runaway dollar inflation situation that could crash the global economy. That's not my base case. That's not a prediction. I don't think that's what's happening. I'll be surprised if that does happen. But it is so important to watch, because if the dollar puts in a new high above that recent high, I think it means we've got a really serious problem. I think it's unlikely that will be the case, but I'm watching it very carefully.
Yeah, Eric, when looking at this dollar index, I mean, we had obviously an incredibly overbought dollar the other week, and it was due for some sort of a mean reversion or correction. That's just what the markets always do. What was interesting is a pullback to 111 or 110 was just simply a 50% retracement of the prior advance from August and September. What will be really interesting now is, as the dollar index turns back up here, will it be able to get back above 113 on the upside? I mean, once we're, if the dollar index was to gain any traction back above 113, back to 114, that breakout to a new high could set in motion another rip. It's going to be so important to see whether the bulls still have gas in the tank. The euro is rejecting along its parity level. It's just such a critical moment.
Now, Eric, I know that you spoke a lot about oil in this session. On the next page, we have the charts on oil. Patrick, what are you thinking regarding this?
Well, Nick, you know, I'm pretty impressed that the bulls were able to clear the 85 level on the upside. Obviously, OPEC being talked about has put this to the forefront, and traders are starting to track this. But the real hurdle for me is the $90 level, largely because a huge amount of the volume through July and August transacted around 90, and there was a big consolidation in that zone. And when we broke down below that $87, $88 level to break lower, the natural bounce here now is back toward this 90 level. If oil was to reject below $90, then the primary downtrend remains intact. But the bulls really do have a shot at this here. But it really does have to show that they are buying dips, and all corrections are quickly accumulated, and they're consolidating the prices solidly above the 90 level. We're going to see it above all of its key moving averages then. It'll be above key fib zones, above key volume profile levels, all sorts of things that would start to actually create some bullish buzz on crude. So let's watch that 90 level going into next week.
On the final chart, we have gold over here. Now, Eric, what are your thoughts?
Well, we hit the 55-day moving average on Tuesday, and it seems like for now at least we're stalled out there. That was at 1734. And if we can get past the 55-day, the next resistance level will be 1767. That's the 100-day moving average. But still, even if we touch that level, we're still below the previous high. We've got a long-standing trend of lower highs and lower lows. We need to see higher highs and higher lows before we can confirm a trend reversal. So right now, all I see is a promising bounce, which I hope continues. But frankly, I'm not going to get excited about this gold market until I see it move above that previous high around 1827 or so, which happens to be just about where the 200-day moving average is. So if we can get above that, well, okay, now we've got above a significant moving average and a new higher high to replace the series of lower highs and lower lows, which we've been seeing for the last several months. Those are the things that need to happen in order to get excited about this market. Until they happen, as far as I'm concerned, the downtrend continues. We're at a bounce. It looks like it might even be reversing right now.
Well, Eric, you know what? When I look at the gold chart, and you just simply overlay just the path from, let's say, the way all cross currencies, including the euro, have behaved, it really just shows that gold has literally been tracking as a cross currency to that U.S. dollar. And I really, in my view on gold, really is that if the U.S. dollar has another rip, then gold has every chance of going back down to retest its lows. I really think that in order for gold to have a bull scenario, it's going to need a short to intermediate high of the dollar to be in, and there's simply not enough technical evidence that that is the case. And so while it's been a really good push on gold and much relief after just months of sustained selling, and at this moment, if we see it roll over here below 1750 and the dollar's ripping, it's still vulnerable for, at minimum, a double bottom retest along the downside. So that's certainly something to keep in mind.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last page of the chart deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we're getting from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Nick Galarnik, and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.